All right, real briefly, here's a map of the world. And as you see there, Pakistan is right here. Oftentimes when people speak about the country of Pakistan, they may throw out the expression Middle East. Well, actually, it's not the Middle East. It's more technically what they call South Asia. Here in this area is what we sort of refer to as the Middle East, but Pakistan is right on the western border of India. And in fact, the history of Pakistan relates greatly to India. And as I was able to discover, at least in terms of the ethnicity, Pakistanians, by and large, share the same ethnic background as Indians. So there again, it's not the Arabs that we consider in terms of what is the majority of the peoples in Pakistan. Just a real brief history, and I have very limited history, and there may be others who know more about it, but Pakistan was in fact created as an official country back in 1947. Before that, it was part of what's referred to as British India. And it was done so for the purpose of establishing an independent nation for the Muslim majority. So you have Muslims who obviously, even before the establishment of that country in India and Indonesia and all that region, and originally it was divided up to this portion and right here where was referred to as East Pakistan, but is now Bangladesh. So there was actually a civil war back in 1971 where Bangladesh separated itself and became an independent country that as we know today as Bangladesh. In terms of its size, it is actually the sixth most populous country in the world. So despite the land mass relative to some of the other larger countries we see, it's filled with people. And you can kind of relate that, of course, to India, which is, you know, the second largest populous country in the world. It's actually the second largest Muslim country, just second only to Indonesia. Again, most people don't think of Indonesia being a highly Muslim populated country, but in fact, it is. So, you know, here's the larger picture. In terms of a closer view, you can see here's Pakistan, and you got India here to the east, Afghanistan to the north, China right to the northeast, and then, of course, you have Iran here on the eastern border in the Arabian Sea. Our flight, or at least the last leg of my flight, was from Dubai, which was only about a two-hour flight to Lahore. So our initial landing was in Lahore, and right before we left, actually the day that we departed Lahore, it was a Monday, there was actually a terrorist attack right around here along the border of India and Pakistan, because there's a lot of infighting between the Pakistanians and the Indians. And so it was at the end of some religious holiday that they celebrate. In fact, the roads were closed off on that Monday when we were traveling because there were going to be these demonstrations of Muslims basically walking down the road, beating themselves and inflicting themselves with pain in memory of some religious figure who had died. And so there was a little bit of unrest during those 2 days as we were getting ready to leave. From Lahore, right here, we drove during the night to Sahiwal, which is roughly, as you see there, 95 miles. And the other little town that I personally visited was Chichewatni, and it's only about 27 miles from Sahiwal. So Sahiwal is the primary location where, you'll see in just a minute, where the ministry that I was observing took place. So this is, again, a little bit of a closer eye view of what's happening. You have Lahore, the airport. You have Sahiwal, the city where the hospital and the school is located. And then there's actually another little town right here, just 27 miles away, called Chichewatni. Again, going at a larger picture, this gives you sort of the landscape of what's happening in Pakistan. Even though, by and large, you have somewhat of a homogeneous ethnic group, as I was saying, from that of what we would consider sort of Indian, in terms of missiology, when they speak of peoples, they're talking about distinction that would also separate them in terms of culture and to somewhat degree language. And as missiologists look at it, there's over 463 different people groups in the country of Pakistan. And what that poses, of course, is a challenge to making the gospel known. Because, you know, we may think, okay, we even have churches, we even have denominations in Pakistan. But the fact that you have those groups of people who are Christians does not automatically mean they have the ability to reach out to these other people groups. Because like in a lot of these ancient cultures, there's a lot of tribal factions. There's a lot of hostility between these people groups. So it doesn't easily make the gospel presentation to those people reach. And along with that, you have over 77 different languages. English is actually the official government language. And in fact, as early as 2nd, 3rd, and 4th grade, you have students in schools who are learning all of their instruction in English. They learn all in English. They use British standard of education. And that's, of course, because of, again, India and Pakistan were part of the British Empire way back when. The more native language, if you will, is called Urdu. And that's the language that's spoken by most of the natives or the native Pakistanis in Pakistan. Here's the gloomy picture right here. 96% of the population are Muslim. And then you have a small percentage, less than 4% really, of quote-unquote Christians. That terminology or that designation is probably worse than what we refer to as Christians here. Because Christianity there is a legally recognized religion. So you're born a Christian. If your parents are Christian and you're born into their family, you are, by legal standards, a Christian, so you can practice Christianity. But if you're a Muslim and you convert to Christianity, even though there aren't any legal ramifications per se, you'll find a great deal of social pressure, just sort of the way Sebastian was talking about in Turkey. And you'll have family members or religious groups who will end up persecuting, possibly even martyring that individual. So there's sort of a deterrent, if you will, in becoming Christian in Pakistan. Here's some of the figures. Again, when it comes to self-identified, that's a very broad category, almost legal designation. And so you got 4.5 million Christians, which only makes up 2.5% of the population, and it's growing at a 1.8%. Among those Christians, evangelicals, that would be those who believe the basic tenets of the Christian faith, virgin birth, the Bible being the Word of God, things like that. That only comprises, you see here, almost less than half of those who call themselves Christians. And I'll talk a little bit later about some of the struggles that presents in terms of what's happening there in Pakistan. And so it's less than 1% of the total population. These figures are about 2012, based upon research done by Operation World. These aren't facts that I picked up there. These are available to anybody. When we think of our presence in particular, the Associated Reformed Presbyterian Church, which is one of about seven other Christian denominations or bodies, if you will, in Pakistan, it was kind of eye-opening to me, or just for the first time understanding how it works. The direct link of my visit to Pakistan relates to World Witness. World Witness, again, is the mission board of our denomination, of ARP, here in the United States. My invitation came as a result of the Christian hospital that's located there in Sahiwal, that operates under the authority of World Witness. But in Pakistan, they're established as what they refer to as a society. They have a legal standing in Pakistan under what they refer to as the Nancy Fullwood Hospital Society, basically a board, but it's a legal entity. This board operates, again, under the authority of World Witness, consisting of 11 board members, six of those which our board, World Witness, has direct authority in terms of their appointment. And then the other five members are nationals, Pakistanis there. Now, another extension of World Witness in Pakistan is referred to as ARP Mission. They're also a society that has legal standing in Pakistan. Their primary focus relates to education. Currently, they have four schools in Pakistan with an enrollment of somewhere in the number of 400 students. And there are seven other schools that are still in the possession of the Pakistani government. What's kind of difficult is back in 1972, the Pakistan government nationalized everything. In other words, they took over. And part of that takeover was taking control over the Christian schools that were not only in possession of our denomination, but other Christian denominations that were there. And so at this point, we still have seven other schools that we technically own, meaning our denomination paid for them some time back and built and so forth. But when a government says it's ours, it's theirs, and we're visitors. They're in the process of going through some legal discussions, and it looks favorable that we'll actually get them back. But at this point, we have four schools that are functioning and operating. One of the schools, again, as you'll see a little bit later, is actually located in Sahiwa. These two entities or ministries are directly under World Witness in what we would call our ARP Synod. However, there is also an ARP Synod of Pakistan, meaning it's a national church. They were established all the way back in 1911, again, through much of the missionary efforts that took place through Great Britain and some with the United States. These numbers, of course, are, like any stats, a little bit sketchy. The ARP Synod in Pakistan has, at least right now, 288 churches, which is actually larger in number than the number of churches we have here in our present ARP Synod. Among those numbers are 43,165 members. Now again, that number consists of communicant members, basically anyone who's professed faith, but those numbers are hard to keep up with. And then when you count all those who are born in those families, it's over 180,000 affiliates. Now, what that brings with it is a great deal of unrest and immaturity. Even while we were there in Pakistan during that week, there were a couple of meetings that took place among the old guard and the new guard. About 2 or 3 years ago, some young leaders within the ARP Church of Pakistan staged a coup, a religious coup. What I mean by that was, for almost 6 years, the synod never met in Pakistan. Their whole polity's messed up. Unlike our Presbyterian form of government, it's very patristic. You have a moderator of the synod, and he basically calls all the shots. There are no courts under which they operate, and they pretty much decide what will take place and how things will run. And for 5 or 6 years, there was no synod meeting. They never called those official annual meetings. And so a group of some of the younger leaders within the church decided they were going to call a synod. And they did, and obviously a minority of the ARP church showed up. They had a formal elections, and they elected their own moderator. So you had these two separate moderators, part of the ARP Pakistani synod. Well, there's been a lot of legal suits over property and lots of issues in courts that are still pending. And during my time there, there were actually some efforts made to bring these two groups together. And the last that we heard as we were getting ready to leave was they actually came to some reconciliation. They were going to drop all their suits. Now, if that happens, it'd be a miracle and actually stays that way, because what I've been told is there's always this underlying show of courtesy outwardly, but there's always something going on underneath. And so we'll see what ends up happening. So you've got a lot of unrest within the ARP Church in Pakistan, evidently poor leadership amongst those who are at least a designated leader. And then overall within the church, amongst these 43,000 or 180,000, there's very little discipleship of the Christian faith going on. In fact, as I put down here, there's a great deal of syncretism. In other words, a mixture of religions. You have those who hold to some biblical truth, but then also a lot of witchcraft and other mystical beliefs that are intertwined amongst their belief system. And while I was there, even the director, Keith Ackerman, was telling me that one of the main leaders in the Pakistani church, he knows, goes and pays for some sort of fortune-telling for his future to these witchcraft workers in the community. So, I mean, you got that going on, which obviously gives you some level of unrest and lack of leadership within the church. So my main ministry was here, at least in terms of looking at the hospital. I was able to see a couple of the schools while there, and this was totally off limits. We had one individual in particular who has been for the past several years dealing with this issue. Here's some of the individuals that were part of the work. This is Frank Van Dalen. He's the outgoing executive director of World Witness. This is Alex Pettit next to him. He's the incoming director. Frank, who's been the director of World Witness for the past 10 years, also served in Pakistan for 15 or so number of years. He's been the main sort of mediator between those two warring ARP groups, and he was in on those meetings. This gentleman, Bill, he's actually just a voluntary missionary from Canada. He's actually the clerk of the Canadian Presbytery. He and his wife have come a couple times. She helps in the hospital, and he's been doing some teaching in the schools and in the hospital as well. Rob Patrick, he's a minister in Florida, is the outgoing chairman of the hospital board. Andy Howard, he's sort of the field director for that ARP mission, which deals with all the schools. This gentleman, he's one of the lawyers that's been involved in all these lawsuits. Bill Neely, he's a member of First Presbyterian Church and also on the board of the hospital. LeGrand Cooper, he's the incoming chairman of the hospital board, administrator of First Presbyterian Church. And then this is Keith Ackerman. He's the director of the hospital there in Sahiwal. First Presbyterian Church in Columbia has been very active with the hospital work there, not only in terms of financing, but they had an interim director for a year when there was a great deal of unrest there at the hospital. Again, corruption, a lot of financial underhandedness that was taking place. Robert Belding, who was an elder there, came for a year to try to bring some stability and to see if they would actually stay open. Financially, the hospital, for a long time, was very rocky in terms of its long-term stability. This picture I'll kind of reference later is in front of a school building in Chichewatney, that smaller town that we drove to. All right, when we first landed in Lahore, which is a large city, almost 1.3 or 1.5 million, it's one of the major cities that has an international airport. This was the hotel that we stayed in. Very modern, looks like something you'd see in America. And so that part wasn't too much of a shock. And then also, this is part of the same hotel. They have malls inside the hotel. It's very Western, and it's obviously located in Lahore where you have Westerners who are primarily coming for business and so forth. And so that gives you a picture of, on the one end of the spectrum, of Pakistan. You know, not too different from the life that we would think. But when you get to where we were headed, this is an overview picture of where we were staying. This is a block right here, going down the road up here, cuts up here, and comes down. This little side road is not as easy to see. But the ARP Church, World Witness, owns this whole block, okay? Now, that whole block is fenced off, literally, by a 10-foot wall. There are barbed wires and all other measures. You have gates all along here to prevent, obviously, people getting in and out. You have guards posted at different sites. The hospital here is a fairly large facility. I mean, it's larger, at least in terms of square footage, in terms of the space it takes up, than both Glenwood and St. Francis. So it's not a matter of not having space. What's also located in this area are housing for all the staff doctors. Anybody who's a doctor on staff at the hospital lives on this compound. And you may ask yourself, why would they want to live here? Well, it's actually a privilege to live on this compound. In terms of the standard of life that they receive, along with the protection that they can have here, right there in the compound, they live right here, so they just walk back and forth. I mean, you would think they never get away from their work because they're literally hundreds of yards or less from their work, but they manage. At this point, there are 7 staff physicians. 3 or 4 of them are actually missionaries who have come and are serving, while you have 3 or 4 other local Pakistani physicians. As this property extends, you can see right here another facility. This includes the elementary school, which is pre-K-4 up through 6th grade, and then they have what they call the high school, which is like 7th through 10th. And it's actually a hostel, meaning they come and live there. It's an on-campus facility. This building right here is where we all stayed. It's where also the director of the hospital lives, so he just walks through the woods, and he's there in less than 5 minutes, like a quarter of a mile. And here's another facility for the girls. So on this campus, if you will, you got the hospital, you got the elementary school, you got the girls' high school, you have dwelling for the executive director and all the physicians. They all live on this campus. I didn't get to see much of the outdoors, because once we got situated here, after we left Lahore, we got into this compound. The next morning, or it was actually the same morning, the first thing we did was we went to register at the police station because we had to have on guard security with us wherever we went. So from the time that I arrived on this compound, I only left the place 2 times. Once to go to the police, and then the second time was to drive to Chichewatney, that other small town. I did walk across one time to this other facility right here, which is owned by the Christian Mission as well. And even then, we had to have a guard walk across the street with us, literally. Because the issue that we face as Westerners here in Pakistan is twofold. Not just because we're Christians, per se, but because of the presence of Americans invites a lot of easy prey for kidnappings. They take an American hostage, and they can raise a great deal of ransom for that hostage. And then you also have just regular terrorists that are wanting to draw attention to themselves. It's a very hard life for these missionaries and even the doctors, unless they're Pakistani. Again, they're not as exposed or vulnerable to some of the threats. But if you're a Westerner, you live on this compound. Nurses don't live on here, per se. Some do, but not all. It's mainly the medical and administrative staff, because they couldn't house everybody here. Because most of the nurses are Pakistani. That's the main reason. But again, if you're a Westerner, you have access and to some degree, you have privilege to live on this compound for the safety reason. But you're basically a prisoner. Again, you can go to the market, but when you do, you have to have a transport. And the two times that we traveled, we had this policeman, or actually a truck, with three or four armed guards right in front of us, directing traffic wherever we went. And the traffic there, as you'll see at the end, this is crazy. I felt more fear for my life because of the traffic than I did of any terrorist attacks, literally. I mean, they're weaving through cars and just blowing the horn. It was crazy. I mean, that gave me more stress than anything else. Because a couple of nights, I heard guns just go off in the middle of the night. I'm sure it was just some random act of violence taking place around here. Again, it's just the kind of life they live. It's just chaos. The interesting thing about Pakistani culture is until even a son gets married, he lives with his father. And so we have some of those issues as they're facing as to how to break away from that when they especially bring non-married Pakistani staff on campus or on board their church. This was really eye-opening to me, and one of the reasons why missionary service in Pakistan is as difficult as it is, because you're not just dealing with a culture that's very different from ours, but you live a life of basically confoundment. This is a closer-up picture of the house that we stayed in. It's fairly large, but according to our standards, that's about a 4 in a scale of 10. All right, this is a bunch of details. You know, for most of us, it doesn't mean anything. Some of you medical people may get a real statistical sense of what the hospital's like. Sahiwal is a city of about 500,000 people. The hospital itself was established in 1950. It's a 170-bed facility, so it's large. It's a large facility. Right now, they're only using about 120 because they just don't have the staff to man all those other beds. It also has a fully accredited school of nursing, and that's also located on the same campus. They have 30 students constantly being rotated that's going to the nursing school, and some of them, of course, will serve the hospital, and others will go on. Here's some of the other data. It's a 16-bed ICU, 20 private rooms. What they mean by that is they're located away from the general population, which are typically of a lower socioeconomic status. If you understand the social class of India, there's a very strong caste system in India. Well, some of that is also carried over into Pakistan, but the caste system isn't, of course, just within the Pakistani culture. It's especially within the Muslim and the Christian population. Christians are on the low end and the bottom rung of society. They're the poorest, they're the least educated, and they're definitely the minority when it comes to the religious system. So this hospital, though it does serve both Muslims and Christians, it is especially a benefit to the Christian community because of the way they're treated fairly and, of course, equally here. Here's some data again. Just from January to August, they've had 7,951 admissions, 475 in the ER, and 2,171 charity cases. Now, charity is sort of broad. That means the hospital does pay for some percentage of the cost, while others may receive 100%. Being a Christian hospital and being a ministry in that area, it's hard for them to just turn away all forms of charity. Even though it is a for-profit facility, because you can't run a hospital nonprofit, it'd dry out in a month. I mean, medical costs there is expensive as it is here, naturally. So it is a for-profit venture. And here's some of the figures. And these numbers are a little bit misleading. For example, here, the finances for January, August again, income was $773,450, and here's the expense. But in terms of inflation, it's a little bit different because, let's say, for example, one of the administrators, the top rung officials, employees of the church, he only makes $3,600 a year. And so he's on the top rung of the socioeconomic ladder, but it's $3,600 a year. So you got to sort of base this number based upon that kind of inflationary standards. I think in my head, I did a quick estimate. It's almost, in American dollars, this figure would be 10 times that. So it's like $7.7 million is what they're running today up until August. And here the present staff, they have 5 family practice, 1 OBGYN, and 2 general laparoscopic and endoscopic surgeon. The long-term goal, as they see to be a positive influence in that area, is to obviously increase their medical specialties. This hospital has a very positive reputation in that community. It's viewed as being more technical and of a higher standard than all the other government hospitals, even though it's run by Christians. And so despite the fact that over the past 3 or 4 years, they've had to do a lot of changes, especially with the new administrator coming on, they've gained the favor of that community, even the government official, because they've noticed the benefit it has had on their community to have their medical care. They have a front door, at least the hospital does. Yeah, from the outside. One of those streets has access from the general populace. I mean, you got one door there, you got about 3 guards on the outside with guns, and you got 2 guards on the inside with guns with metal detector. Now, this is probably the most modern depiction of their hospital. You know what these are? Anybody can recognize these? They're dialysis machines, and this is a big deal for them. In fact, their facility is one of the few that is able to run dialysis and have positive results. These 2 are for general cases, and this was one back here they separate for hepatitis patients. And so this is about as high-tech as you're going to get in that hospital. So that's on one end of the spectrum, and here's the other end. Here's their filing system. And they're trying to computerize it, but the difficulty is the whole filing system that's gone on for 30-some years is basically a person comes in, and they give them a number. They come in, they give them another number. So it's like you got to go through all the files to figure out which numbers match you. This is Keith Ackerman, and he's sort of laughing at what they're having to deal with. I mean, these records are, you know, over 30 years old, and they're still trying to work through filing and organizing all this mess. So that's the 2 extremes. You've got technology that's fairly up to par in some respects to American medicine, but then you got this end of the spectrum where they're still trying to get through paperwork. This is the school, and this is obviously the elementary students that are enrolled. Most of them, as you may notice, and it may be hard to tell, are females. Some of that has to do with the history of the school anyway, and I won't go into it, but they're hoping to enlarge the male population of that school as well. And then you have the hostel, which again includes the upper grades, and here you can tell they're all female. The ones that the ARP has now in possession, the government has given them over to them. However, the issues they run into is they still have to be tested by the government standards, meaning they have to be able to answer some of the questions that relate to Pakistani history that's obviously Islamic. They have to answer questions that relate to Islamic law code. So they have to teach that just for the purpose of being able to pass their students on a board level or certification. But the teaching and the curriculum that they use is not as Islamic as a public school there would be. There's a scholarship basis. You know, those who can pay, others who can't afford to do receive scholarships. You know, you can see all the different colors of their clothing, and is also evident here, they pretty much cover every part except for their face. They don't wear all the head coverings, like at least the facial covering, like some of the real fundamental Muslims do. Not everyone's required to wear the facial covering like you have in some of the really extreme Islamic states. This is a school in Chichewatney, which is about 25 miles away, and they built this just in the past year. And this is right now just an elementary school. Their desire, as you'll see, is to enlarge it and have a full campus in this town. They make such a big deal about Westerners. It's kind of embarrassing. When we arrived, they had a big old ceremony. We're walking past here, and they're throwing these little rosebud all in our face as we're walking through. It is sweet, but kind of makes a big deal about nothing. And they're also coming and doing a little presentation for us. This school goes up to, I think, 6th grade. And, you know, even here, you see these guys, these are guards, and here's a big old gate to the school. Safety there is just an everyday reality, just for vandalism, for random acts of violence. So everything that's kind of protected has walls, has guards. It's kind of unusual as you think about life. Back in the 70s, you know, there was a lot of unrest, and the government has become more and more hostile towards Christians and the West. This is another building that's adjacent to the other building right across. It'll look pretty much identical to it, and sort of prayer dedication as they continue to build it. these poles are what keep the ceilings from collapsing. It's kind of archaic. Concrete's been poured, and so they're just waiting for it to settle. So you have this view of Pakistan, as I walk away from it, that's one of great unrest, not just politically, but also spiritually. It was sad to see the church, which has been there for 100 years, the ARP Pakistani Church has been there 100 years, and yet, I mean, they're as immature and infantile spiritually as you can get because all the leaders are. There aren't many leaders within the church who have much of a training, not just in terms of theology and academics, but they don't have real discipleship. And so corruption, a lot of infighting, and all that persists in the church, which bleeds out to the congregation and the people in the church. You can't grow spiritually if you don't have teachers and ministers who can train them. So that was very disheartening on the one hand. When you think about the people, the Pakistanian, there's such a dearth of order and purpose. Education is a hot commodity because it is a doorway to the West. It's a doorway to the West. As I wrestled with this whole issue of even our presence in Pakistan, at least as a mission, is twofold. We have obviously hospitals that are meeting the physical and the medical needs of both Christians and Pakistanians. And it's a great opportunity because once they come to the hospital, they're open to any kind of evangelism. There are chaplains who serve the hospital. All the nurses are trained in terms of Christian discipleship. So anytime they interact with the patients, who are 90% Muslim, they get to share the gospel with them. And they're very open to hearing the gospel. I didn't have this other picture, but there's like a wall of tracts, Christian tracts, that people come by and pick up anytime they want, and they have to fill it every day. There was actually a little Bible of the Gideons that I took a picture of. But you also have, amongst that, a great deal of tension for the Christians who are also being educated, but by and large are still at the very bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. I mean, for a Christian to make it in society, not only do they need to have top-notch education, but they need to have positions and jobs that are of influence. But if they are given that opportunity, the temptation is very great just to flee the country, just leave. I mean, why stay if doors are open elsewhere? And so I started thinking about that and said, well, you know, what does that do to the church then? It basically depletes them of all their top people, both academically, both educationally, and even financially in that society. So I was talking with them. It's like, well, how do you try to get these people to stay? Which is kind of hard to say. How do you encourage them to love their country and to love the people in their country? Because if they leave, what's the future of Christian Pakistanians in the years to come? I mean, it's a hard question. We would want for our children to have the best opportunities. We would want our children to do better than we did. And so it's hard for us to inculcate into these Pakistani Christians, well, you need to just stay here. This is where God has called you to rest your roots and to see the country grow. But unless the church, unless the Christian church becomes stronger, I mean, they have no chance to, humanly speaking, survive and be of influence in that country. So there's a great deal of tension, even as it comes to ministry. When you're serving the poor, poor Christians or even poor Muslims, how much do you ask in terms of funding? I mean, how far can a business, school, or hospital go and survive if they're constantly doing, quote, charity work? I mean, the hospital found out very soon they can't. And so they had to establish some limits as to what level of charity they can give before they have to close the doors. And the schools that are operating, they're not as pressed because they tend to limit the percentage of Muslims that are allowed into the school. Because one of the laws that they have in Pakistan is if you get above 45%, I think, of Pakistani enrollment, then you have to basically provide them places to pray and go through all the Islamic religious way of life. So they're going to avoid that at all costs, not to give that over. And so there's a long-term tension as to how ministry and how the future of that church is going to be able to prosper. Because, you know, at its present rate, they'll always be sort of the bottom of the totem pole. And the few that are able to become educated and have opportunity, they're going to take the first opportunity they can to flee for the West and look for a better life elsewhere. I guess in that sense, the human heart is no different there than here. It's no different than the hearts that Jesus ministered to. You know, they were more than willing to receive of his miracles and powers when he was giving them out freely. But then when life became hard, they kind of scattered. So that question is hard to answer because of the double challenge of the fact that, again, for a Muslim, converting means persecution and death. So how they receive the gospel and then at the same time how they live out the Christian faith in that society, I raise that question myself and says, you know, unless the church, the Christian church, is strong and in a sense provides some sort of haven for these converts, they're on their own, almost dare say closet Christians, to just seek out some level of fellowship and community amongst other Christians in a very secretive way. It's hard. The director and I stayed up one night trying to wrestle with that question. I was like, okay, because I asked him, are there any underground churches here? Meaning, are there churches that are Christian that from Pakistani converts that you know of me? He says, no, I mean, that's not possible. And I struggled with that question. What do you mean it's not possible? There are underground churches in many closed countries, but they do at the risk of their lives. So, you know, I'm sort of posing the question, are you saying that their faith is not sufficient to where they're willing to risk their lives for Christ? And of course, you know, he's not going to stand in judgment of that. And who am I to stand in judgment of that? This is a picture. It's a video. As I say there, it's the epitome of life in Pakistan. As I went about, it kind of gives me a glimpse of what life, this is obviously a physical representation, but of the seated, deep-rooted issues that they faced. That's life. Did you see the traffic? There are no traffic lights. People just come to the intersection, and they're looking out to the left and the right, make sure they don't hit somebody or they don't get hit by somebody. That's that way as you're driving down the road because there's no lanes. You just kind of drive and you're always beeping your horn to let somebody know you're coming up behind them and passing them on the right. But that picture depicts for me just the daily struggles of not just the Christian faith, but just of the whole infrastructure that you see in a country like Pakistan where Islam rules. It's darkness. It's chaos. There's no order. It's survival of the fittest. To a certain degree, it's very evolutionary. I mean, that to me is just evolutionary process. You get in front of people so you don't have to worry about them coming up behind you. That's how they drive. And some of the sad scenes that we've passed many times, you have those guys riding those motorcycles. They have little babies, like 10, 8 months old, literally, on their laps as they're driving through that kind of traffic. Because that's what they have to do. That's how they transport themselves, and that's how they get from one place to another. And it weighs upon, I'm sure, the hearts of any Christian Pakistanian who wants to see their country change. But there's so many layers that you have to get through, not just culturally, not just infrastructure, not just the obvious Islamic influence, but everything that's involved, even within the church itself, that's a hindrance to seeing the minimal level of prosperity that we enjoy here. It just befuddles me to think that some of the things that we struggle with here, you know, Christians there or just people there, they can't even imagine. They can't even fathom what life is like for us. And so obviously we come back with a heart of gratitude, but also a heart of wanting to see God do things there in a country that is, again, 99% Muslim. When you think about that, it's a double-edged sword because there's a great deal of darkness opposed to it. But there aren't many countries that Christians can have a legitimate presence with the gospel in a 99% Islamic state, which is the official name, the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. That's the name of their country. But we're there. We have Christians there, and it's only up to the Lord to what can happen in the days to come. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your promise that Christ gave to his disciples and to us even, that he will build his church and the gates of Hades will not prevail. And so we thank you that we are a part of that triumphant church that is marching on and that we can participate in the spread and in the advancement of your kingdom. We ask that you would penetrate our hearts, especially as comfortable Westerners who live life overcome by so many issues that may seem petty in light of the kingdom of God. And yet we ask, O Lord, that even through those
small trials, that we would be given over to praying for the great needs of so many of our brothers and sisters in the Lord, not only in Pakistan, but in other Muslim countries where the gospel is meeting resistance, and yet we know that nothing is too difficult for you. And so we pray, O Lord, that you would bless the work of ARP missions in Pakistan, along with so many others who are seeking to bring the light of the gospel into such darkness, that you would be pleased to raise up in generations to come a faithful and a vibrant church throughout those regions. For it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.